Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inch. Very glad to have you with us this morning. We begin another couple of conversations. Probably for as long as humans have been around, or at least going back a long way in human history, people have recognized the need for secure communications, particularly in areas of war and politics. And probably about as soon as people started writing things down, they started to develop ways to encode that information. So if it fell into the wrong hands, the information wouldn't be available. That is a continuing concern, and in fact, it's maybe even a greater concern now in the age of the internet than it ever has been before, because what one person can invent, another person can crack. And for some time, people have been on this quest to find a kind of security method, a way of encoding data and information that would be completely secure. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about a method that seems to provide the answer to that need, something called public key cryptography. And if you don't know what this is, have no fear, we'll explain it to you and talk about what it is and where it came from and why it's important. We have two guests here with us. In studio, Nigel Boston. He's professor, associate professor of mathematics at the University of Illinois. He is also director of the Illinois Center for Cryptography and Information Protection. And joining us by telephone is Simon Singh. He is a journalist who specializes in writing about science and mathematics. He's the author of a couple of books. His first, which was a bestseller in the UK and also did very well here in the United States, was Fermat's Enigma. That's the title of the U.S. version of the book. In 1997, he began working on his second, titled The Code Book, which is a history of codes and code breaking. And you might recall that he was here on this program with us, and we talked about the code book. As a result of that book, he got involved again, as he had been before, in television and did a series for British television on the science of secrecy. And there is also a companion book to that series, which is titled The Science of Secrecy. Simon Singh will be visiting Champaign-Urbana. In fact, he'll be here tomorrow to give a talk, which is part of an event to celebrate the golden anniversary of the University of Illinois Coordinated Science Laboratory. He'll be talking on this very topic about the secret history of public key cryptography tomorrow afternoon at 4:15. This will be in 314 Altgeld Hall on the U of I campus. And, of course, anybody who is interested is welcome. The events are open to the public. Also, following that at 5:45, he'll be doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore at the Author's Corner. So if you're interested in meeting him, he will be there and you can stop by. And as we talk here this morning, your questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, Professor Boston, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And here on the telephone with us, Simon Singh.
Oh, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
To start out here, I guess, we should talk just at least a little bit about this business of code. And maybe the way to start out would be like this. I know that if we, say, the three of us decided that we wanted to exchange letters, we're going to write to each other. We wanted to make sure that if somebody else got that letter, they wouldn't be able to read it. We could figure out a way of doing that. We could, for example, write out our letters. We could sit down, and then we could say, well, for every letter of the alphabet in our message, we'll count four over, and we'll take that letter and then write that down and send that. And that means that anybody who would get one of these letters would look at it. It would just be a jumble of letters. It wouldn't make any sense. The problem, though, is that we all know how this works. And the more people that know the key, the more difficult it is to maintain the secrecy of that communication. So there sort of is the initial problem for what's called I guess that's a symmetric system.
Yeah, I mean, we have a very real situation now in that I'm over here in New York and you're there in Illinois, and I may have some secret communication that I want to send to you in advance of my arrival tomorrow. And I'm obviously not going to tell you what that secret message is on the phone, because this is being broadcast all over the state. So I want to encrypt, I want to scramble up this message, maybe it's an email that I'm going to send, and then I'll scramble it up and I'll send it to you. And it'll get to Illinois, but the problem is I haven't told you how to unscramble it. We've never met before. And the question is, how do I get that scrambling recipe? You correctly called it a key. How do I get that recipe to you? I need some very secure method. And the problem is that if there was a secure method for me to deliver the key to you, then I'd use that method to deliver the message. So it's a sort of a vicious circle.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess so. The issue is that when we come to public key cryptography, it goes back to the example before. That is, in that example, what I'd say, we're going to agree there's going to be this code. We're all going to know how it works. I use it on my end to encode the message, and then you use it on your end to decode the message. So there's only one, basically there's one key.
That's
the same. We both have it. And because there's only this one and we have to exchange it, or anybody else I would send my message to, if I wanted them to read it, well, I'd have to give them the key too. Then that makes it much more difficult to keep the whole thing secret, because everybody uses the same key. So then we come to public key cryptography, and the thing that makes this different is there are two keys. You use one to encode and one to decode, and you can make one public and keep the other one secret, and by doing that, that means that this is actually, we now have what seems to be the perfect way of doing this.
Well, it seems to work pretty well right now, except that each of these public key crypto systems depends on solving some very hard mathematical problem. And we number theorists are getting better at solving these mathematical problems. So in other words, to find the private key from the public key so that you have the same power as the person who's supposed to decode it, then you have to solve this problem. And for instance, factoring a large integer is the basis of the most popular system right now, the RSA system. And there are huge advances in our ability to factor large integers using quite advanced mathematics. And because of that, RSA is turning to longer and longer key lengths, which is restricting where it can be used. For instance, if they're in a Palm Pilot or where there's some constrained environment, then you might not be able to use RSA.
Hmm. See, it's a very important idea that you've just mentioned, the the concept of a public key and a private key. So, and as you say, they're not symmetric. So the public key is something that you can send to everybody. You can put it on the web, you can put it in a phone directory, you can put it on your business card, and it's essentially instructions for how to encrypt your message. But that information, those instructions, are of no use whatsoever when it comes to decrypting the message. That information is distinct, and I keep that secret. So anybody can encrypt a message and send it to me, but only even though they know how to do this, only I know how to undo it. And sort of there are lots of analogies in everyday life which sort of fit this. For example, we can all put letters in the mailbox. That's easy. But only the mailman has the key to open the box and get the letters out. Anyone can put something in the back of a car and slam the trunk shut. But only if you've got the key can you open it. Hmm. So these are lots of examples of what you might call one-way operations. They're very easy to do in one direction. It's very easy to put the letter in the letterbox. It's very easy to slam the trunk shut. But undoing them, getting the letters out of the mailbox, opening the trunk is very hard. And that's what all of these systems are based on, that sort of easy to do, very difficult to undo, unless you have some special knowledge, which, as you say, you call it the private key. Hmm.
And I gather another one of the assets or the benefits of a system like this is that also because anyone has the public key, they can encrypt the message, but only I have the private one and only I can decode it, then that also tells me if I receive a message from someone, whether in fact, I guess I'm not sure exactly how this works, but I know that it does work, that I can have some assurance that that message did in fact come from that person that it says that it came from. Otherwise, the decrypted version after I use my private key, it wouldn't make any sense. If it comes out and if it's actually I can read it, then I know, well, yeah, Simon Singh really did send me this message.
Yeah, and this is a very important aspect of cryptography. We're, you know, we've sort of been focusing on secrecy and privacy so far, but cryptography is all about identity of the sender. You know, when I scramble up this email and send it to you, how do you know it's really from Simon Singh? Also, sometimes I'm not worried about secrecy. If I order a book online, I don't care if anybody knows I've ordered that book, but I don't want anybody to tamper with that message and order 10 books instead of one. And similarly, when the retailer receives this order, I don't want them to be able to say a month later, we never received your order. So I want the ability to have non-repudiation. And cryptography can guarantee all of these elements. You know, similarly, if you're going to vote online, cryptography can make that vote secret. It can determine who sent the vote. It can also check that vote is not tampered, and it can check that vote was indeed received and can't be repudiated. So all of these elements are very important.
Hmm. I was going to say that people have been discussing voting by internet lately a lot, and it seems like a lot of the technical problems are really way beyond what we can handle right now. You know, I mean, we can't even stop viruses and junk email. How are we going to really make all these things happen? It's just, I think right now we're not at the stage where we can handle voting. It's just too huge a problem.
Yeah. But the example that Simon Singh just gave does suggest that this is something that could indeed does touch people in many ways, not just people who are doing something that requires a very high level of security in data transmission. It could affect anyone, including people who shop for their books online at Amazon.
Sure. You send your credit card over the internet. I mean, all these issues come up right away.
When you hit send on your browser, once you've typed in your credit card details, the browser automatically encrypts your information. Using a public key, sends it to the .com, who then have the private key to unscramble it for you. So one of the problems, I think, with security on the internet is that although it is there, and it's pretty strong in virtually all cases, because it's so invisible, people have difficulty accepting that it can be strong. You know, when we lock our cars and we hit that sort of electronic beeper, we hear that beep and we know something clever is happening. But when we hit enter on our keyboard, we don't have that same reassurance that a complex scrambling algorithm is really protecting us. Mm.
Well, just a couple of moments ago here, Professor Boston talked about the fact that while this does involve a very complicated mathematical formula, we are getting better and better at being able to crack the code. And I suppose if you were an experienced mathematician, you had a supercomputer, eventually you could do that. That raises the question, is it possible to develop an unbreakable code?
I was talking earlier about one-way operations. You know, you can slam the trunk door shut, but you can't open it. The mathematical principle that's at the heart of many of these systems is that it's very easy to multiply two numbers to get a third number. So if I say, what's 11 times 13, people can say, well, 10 13s are 130, so 11 13s are 143. So they can do that pretty quickly. But if I give you the result, let's say the result is 221, there's no easy way to go backwards. Mm-hmm. So again, you have this easy one way, hard in the other direction. So, you know, in fact, the answer is 13 times 17, which I can calculate very easily, but people have to think a while before they can go backwards. And so the security of many of these public key crypto systems depends on using very large numbers, multiplied together. And the larger the numbers, the more secure the system. So if you're a code breaker and you have a really powerful computer, all I do is I just use bigger numbers. And you build a bigger computer in 10 years' time, I'll just use even bigger numbers. So I don't think it's, conventional computing, I don't think will ever really catch up with this system. What would be required is either a radically new way to factor numbers, that's going backwards from multiplying, or a radically new computer technology.
Hmm. I disagree slightly with that, in that there are limitations sometimes on the power and the space that the device you want to use the cryptography with has. And so, you know, you can't arbitrarily keep lengthening the key lengths and the size of the integers that you're working with if you want to use it in some, you know, limited environment. And as a result, some of the companies that we're working with, such as Motorola, are turning to other systems that use other problems where they can keep their key lengths short. It doesn't mean that RSA isn't going to keep being used where there is no limitation on key lengths, but if you want handheld devices, as people want, you know, PDAs, Palm Pilots, whatever, then they're not willing to have huge handheld devices that require this sort of key length.
Let me introduce again our guest here for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit. We're talking with Nigel Boston. He's here in the studio with me. He's professor of math at U of I, also director of the Illinois Center for Cryptography and Information Protection. And on the telephone, Simon Singh. He's a journalist who specializes in writing about science and mathematics. He's authored several books. One of them is A History of Code, which is titled The Code Book. And then his most recent is a companion to a series that he did for British television, which is titled The Science of Secrecy, that covers some of that same information that's in the code book. And he's going to be here to talk about this very topic tomorrow on the U of I campus. He'll be giving a talk on the secret history of public key cryptography at 4:15 tomorrow afternoon at Altgeld Hall in room 314. So if you're interested in hearing that, you can do that. And questions here are welcome too in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I want to ask Simon Singh to give us a little thumbnail sketch of the history of public key cryptography. I guess it's my understanding that there are some competing claims as to who it is that actually did develop this. From the kind of work that you've done, who is responsible? Who can we say came up with the idea of public key cryptography?
The important thing to appreciate, I think, is that for 2,000 years, people thought this was impossible. People thought that, you know, if I'm going to scramble up a message and send it to you, I have to somehow get the key to you. And traditionally, that meant employing a courier to deliver it to you, which is slow and expensive and sort of risky if you can't trust the courier. So for 2,000 years, nobody even tries to solve this problem. And then there are various sort of papers that are published that sort of approach the problem tangentially, but the first big breakthrough that hit the newspapers happened at Stanford. Three gentlemen by the name of Whit Diffie, Ralph Merkel, and Marty Hellman, they came up with the concept of how you might solve this problem. And indeed, 3 years later, well, that was in, say, 1975. In 1977, three gentlemen in Boston, Ron Rivest, Adi Shamir, and Len Adelman, actually constructed the mathematical architecture that implemented the concept. And it's their system, RSA, Rivest, Shamir, Adelman, that's one of the very popular systems. Now, for 25 years, people accepted this as the birth of public key cryptography. But what emerged in 1997, while I was writing the book, in fact, was that in Britain, in America, you have the National Security Agency, the NSA, which is responsible for government code and code breaking. In Britain, we have an organization called GCHQ, Government Communication Headquarters, and they do the same thing. And it appears that in 1969, a chap called James Ellis came up with a concept about 3 or 4 years ahead of the Stanford trio. And in 1973, a young man by the name of Clifford Cox came up with RSA, but 4 years ahead of RSA, Rivest, Shamir, and Adelman. But because they worked for a government agency, they were forbidden to talk about their work or publish it. So these gentlemen, James Ellis, Clifford Cox, and also a chap called Malcolm Williamson, had made the greatest breakthrough in cryptography for 1,000 years, and yet they couldn't tell anybody what they'd done, and then they had to watch as Whitfield Diffie, Martin Hellman, and Ralph Merkel and RSA made their breakthroughs. And so you have two parallel discoveries. And Whit Diffie, who was involved in the American discovery, actually met up with James Ellis. And I think Whit Diffie more or less accepts that the GCHQ may have got there first. But the important two points I think that are worth mentioning. One is that, you know, although the Brits may have got there first, it was discovered independently in America. It was publicized here in America. It was commercialized here. And if it hadn't been for the work of the American scientists and mathematicians, the information age may not have progressed as rapidly as it has done. So that's absolutely crucial. And then the second thing is that I was talking earlier about the ability to identify yourself. And you described sort of how you might use a public key and a private key system to do that. Well, it seems that GCHQ had no appreciation of this aspect of their invention. So again, that concept really was born here in America. And it's absolutely vital. You know, if I go into a shop, they recognize my face. I can establish trust with a handshake. I can build up a relationship with that person. Similarly, cryptography, by giving you digital signatures and so on, can do same a similar sort of thing for people who've never met. So again, that's really a very American discovery that GCHQ seem to have overlooked.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, because a couple of years ago I interviewed Whitfield Diffie, and he wrote a book. Which I still had, and when in thinking about this interview, I pulled it down off the shelf and started looking at it. And here he lays out the claim, just as you say, he and another guy at Stanford, and this guy at was it UC Berkeley?
Well, Ralph Merkel was at Berkeley, yeah. And he wanted to work on this problem of public key cryptography. He said, "No, I want to invent a system where you don't need to distribute the keys." And his supervisor thought this was such a crazy idea. And Berkeley likes crazy ideas. This is even too crazy for Berkeley. So he, too, had to move down to Stanford to join Whit Diffie and Martin Hellman.
So this book was published, I think, in 1998. So at that time, Whit Diffie, these other guys, they didn't know anything about these British researchers that were working on the same stuff.
Well, Whit Diffie did know because he was part of a very select group of people who had been informed. But he was forbidden to talk about it because this was still classified information. So when he submitted his manuscript, probably in 1997, he couldn't write about it. And pretty much when that book was published, this news began to emerge into the public realm. And so although he'd been aware of it all the time, he wasn't able to include it in that book.
We're already at the midpoint of this part of Focus 580. Again, your questions are welcome as we talk with Simon Singh. He's joining us by telephone. Nigel Boston here in the studio with me. We're talking some about public key cryptography, what it is and how it was developed and why it's important. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. You want to add anything to the...
One thing I'd like to add is that there's not just Simon Singh's lecture at 4:15 tomorrow, but he's also giving a lecture at 1:30 for school children, ages about 10 to 18, in CSL rather than in Altguild. So that's just southeast of the Beckman Institute, and school children and their teachers are welcome. We have a number coming, and I think there's still a little room. And also at 3 o'clock, there's another person, John Lawrence, coming, who has a fully operational German Enigma machine that he's driving from Canada with him right now, I believe. And he's going to demonstrate it and allow people to poke and prod it. So that will also be in 314 Altguild before Simon's talk.
And this is this very famous code machine that was developed by the Germans and was used in World War II and eventually also was cracked by a group of British.
Well, the Simon Poles, there was a Pole, I mean, Simon tells the story in his book.
In the book, yeah, that's right.
Was the first person, and in fact, this is what John Lawrence will be talking about at 3 o'clock. He's going to give a talk on how this Polish researcher, Rejewski, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, was actually the person to make the first breakthrough. And then his ideas were then developed further by the British at Bletchley Park to defend against similar German Enigma machines.
In fact, when when he was doing his work, the Polish codebreaker Rajewski, which is, I think, probably in the early 30s, it was well before the outbreak of war, there were German cryptographers in Berlin saying the Enigma is absolutely unbreakable. It can never be broken. It's far too formidable for any codebreaker. And yet they didn't know that a few hundred miles away somebody had cracked it. And so, you know, earlier on when I was saying that RSA is pretty much unbreakable and I'll build a bigger machine if you build a bigger machine, there could be somebody in Poland at this very moment or somewhere somewhere else in the world who knows something that I don't and many other people don't.
Yeah. Probably it's NSA.
We have a caller here. Why don't we talk with them in southeastern Illinois on our toll-free line number 4. Hello.
Yes, this may be an impossible question, and I may just be slow, but your explanation hasn't explained it to me on how you can have how some one person can know the key to put something in to encode, and that the other person. Are we assuming that there is only one encoding key, and anybody who would be decoding would know that encoding key? And if that's the case, why do they need a decoding key? I mean,
perhaps I can offer a couple of analogies. So I want to send you a message. Sorry, I didn't catch the caller's name.
We generally don't ask callers to give their names, but
okay, well, I'm going to call you Bob. Because in cryptography, you tend to have two characters, Alice and Bob, A and B. So I'm going to try and send you a message, Bob. And I put the message in a box, and I close the lid, and I put a padlock on the box. I snap the padlock shut. And that's like encrypting it, because I've protected the message. And I send the box to you. Now, the problem is you don't have the key to open the padlock. So this is our old key distribution problem raising its head again. Mm-hmm. What you do is you take your padlock and snap that on the box too. So you now have a doubly padlocked box. You send the box back to me. I can take my padlock off now because I've got the key. I've always had the key to my own padlock. I've now got a box with one message in it and one padlock, and that's your padlock, the one you put in when I sent it to you first time around. I'm going to send it back to you now. You've got a box with a padlock on. It's your padlock. You can open it, open the lid, and now you can read the message. So this is a situation where two people who've never met have been able to have secure communication. The box was always padlocked in transport, and yet at the end of the day, you were able to open the box and read the message.
Well, now, does the person doing the decoding know the encoding? Is there only one encoding key? And does the person knowing the decoding know that encoding key?
Okay, let me give you another analogy. That first analogy just sort of says, look, these things, strange things are possible. Things that you might think are impossible seem to be possible. Now, the way this system really works is in a slightly different way. Now, you're waiting for a message from me. So what you do is the following. You have a padlock and a key. And you put the key in your pocket and you keep that secret. You never show that to anybody. But the padlock, you make 1,000 copies and you send them to every post office in America. And these padlocks are open, okay? Now, I want to send you a message. I just go to a post office here in Manhattan and I say, can I have one of Bob's padlocks? I put the message in a box, I close the lid, and I snap the padlock shut. Because anyone can snap a padlock shut. You don't need the key for that. Then I send you the box, and you've already got the key to unlock your own padlock. So here you can see you've got a key, which we're going to call the private key. I've got something, a padlock, which so far we've been calling it the public key. But it, you know, in the way I've just described it, it's more of a padlock. And the encoding, you know how to encode and decode. You know everything. But you've given other people the information required to encode. So I've got this padlock, and I can use it to encode anything I want to send to you. But I've got no idea how to open this padlock, because I don't have the key. You never gave me that key, and I don't even need to see this key, because all I'm ever doing is encrypting things to you. If you ever wanted to encrypt something and send it to me, you would go to your post office and say, can I have one of Simon's padlocks? And then we could do it the other way as well. Does that help?
Some, I think. In other words, the person who is receiving the message, it's necessary for the person sending the message to have the receiver's padlock. And
yeah,
then he uses that padlock, and those padlocks are all over the place. I mean, everybody's got a padlock.
That's it.
But if that box falls into somebody else's hands, all they have is the padlock. They don't have the key.
That's right. It's like a checkbook and a paying in book. I don't care if I leave my paying in book lying around, because that's not a security. I don't care if somebody pays more money into my bank account. It's the checkbook or the key that's the really secure thing you have to look after. And the other thing you said that was really important is that it's the receiver that's doing all the work. You know, so far, you know, for thousands of years, people said, well, if I'm sending you a message, then I'm going to encrypt it, I'm going to pick the key, I'm going to do all the hard work. But what's happening here is that the receiver is actually doing a lot of the work. As we're on the phone...
Both codes belong actually to the receiver. The receiver is promulgating both codes, and... The sender is simply using the code that the receiver has made available.
That's right. So if you buy something online, you're not encrypting it with your code. You're encrypting it with the .com's code. And they obviously have the key to decode it at the other end.
But all anyone else would have would be the encoding key.
That's right. That's
right. Well, in somebody else's hands, all they have is the encoding key.
I was saying earlier on that some people had sort of approached this idea even before GCHQ and the people in Stanford. And one of the ideas that was, I think, developed at AT&T Labs, Bell Labs, was that you and I, you know, we're on the phone now. Let's say you want to send me a message. What I could do is I could generate some random noise at my end and send that down the phone. Now, I know what that random noise is. I'm the receiver, and I know what the random noise is because I'm sending it down the line. You send me your message, which is hidden by all of this horrible random noise, but I can take the noise off because I generated it to understand what you're actually saying.
Okay, I suspect that this is so complicated it's difficult to understand, but I ask one final question then. If, as you say it, it seems fairly simple, so why are extremely complicated mathematical formulas necessary? Is that simply to make the decoding more difficult? Or is that essential to the concept?
Well, the mathematics that I explained earlier, which was, you know, if you multiply two numbers together and get a result, that's easy, but it's very difficult to go backwards. That's kind of pretty elementary.
Yeah, but the mathematics that you mentioned were extremely simple. I mean, why are extremely complicated mathematics? I mean, I gathered from what you were saying that extremely complicated mathematics were necessary to...
Sure. What I was going to say was that process of multiplying is easy and going backwards is hard. Going backwards is... There is no easy way to do it. It's absolutely impossible. Well, not impossible. It's just phenomenally difficult to go backwards. So that's like a padlock that doesn't even have a key, because nobody has any ability to go backwards easily. So you actually have to embed that idea within a larger concept. And then once you've built that larger concept, you have many other aspects that you need to build into your crypto system, such as, you know, we all have to have our own private key. So how do you generate that private key? Well, you have to do that by generating some random numbers and finding a couple of very large prime numbers. So you have to build in that sort of mathematical part into the crypto system and so on and so on. So there are many elements to building a complete system. And
I'm going to get off here because I'm taking too much time, but that brings up another question. Am I understanding you to say now that... that different people would have different encoding keys, that there's more than one encoding key, that this one decoding key decodes all of them?
Oh, no, no. If I was setting up my public key and my private key, I would only have one public key, or one encoding key, and one decoding key, and everybody would have access to the encoding key. Okay. I'm not sure what I quite said a second ago, but I didn't mean to give the opposite impression.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you.
All right. I think our mathematician here was itching to get in on this. Would you want to?
Well, I was just going to comment that where the complicated mathematics comes in is not in applying the method. The method is high school math. It's in trying to break the system is often where it enters, in trying to deduce the private key given the public key. So it's in trying to reverse that supposedly one-way function. There is, to answer your question from before, there is no known perfect one-way function, but to actually reverse that supposedly one-way function is where a lot of very advanced mathematics has come in.
Well, does it make it that much, how much easier does it make it to try to determine the private key if you know what the public key is?
Well, everybody knows what the public key is.
Okay. So it really doesn't help you very much.
No. The strength comes from the difficulty of the problem that you have to solve. So like Simon says, the difficult problem here in the most common system RSA is to take a very large number, which you know is a product of two smaller numbers, and to deduce from that what the two smaller numbers are. You can take the two smaller numbers, multiply them together. That's take you a few seconds maybe, but to take some huge number, and we're talking numbers, 300 digit numbers maybe in current what's considered secure for RSA, and trying to factor those into what two integers make that up, that requires quite a lot of sophistication.
I think Nigel is right that we could now download some software for free off the internet and use very large numbers, let's say 300 digits long each, to multiply them together to get a 600-digit number. And I might be wrong on the numbers, Nigel, but it's something like, if you take all the computers in the world and run them for a billion years, they would not be able to factor a number that's, say, 600 digits long. Is this sort of the right sort of ballpark?
Well, currently, but people have been wrong in the past. There was the RSA 129 challenge. So RSA put out a 129-digit number as a challenge on which some message was encrypted using that. And they estimated that it would take however many trillion years before computing power would get to the point of being able to do it. But actually, it took... I can't do the subtraction quickly enough, but less than 20 years to do that. Not because of advances in computing, though that did help a little bit, but more in advances in clever mathematical ideas. And currently we can't factor a 600-digit number, but one of two things could happen. The mathematics could advance to a level where we can really factor larger numbers by being cleverer. And the second thing is quantum computers, of course, which is an area that actually this university just hired an expert in quantum computing as a Bardeen chair in physics. Paul Quiert, and this is an exciting area. There was just an article in New York Times on that area.
Well, I'm glad though to hear that the human brain is still a factor here.
It still
matters.
It makes things quicker than computing advances.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have two guests here in the studio with us. Nigel Boston, he's director of the Illinois Center for Cryptography and Information Protection. He's also associate professor of mathematics at University of Illinois. Joining us by telephone is Simon Singh. He's a journalist who specializes in writing about science and math. He has a book that looks at the history of code, which is titled The Code Book. So if you're interested in the subject, you can seek that book out. And as we've mentioned a couple of times, he will be talking on the U of I campus tomorrow. And we'll try to give you the information again one more time near the end of the show. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Urbana here. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, I still don't quite understand this, because it sounds like you're saying if you take a beginning number and multiply it by 3 and by 7, which are two primes, and you get this result, that you're not going to be able to get back to the original number by dividing by 21, which doesn't make any sense to me. But
it's slight miscommunication there. Okay, let me pose you a problem. If I say to you, can you tell me what 11 times 15 is? Can you tell me the answer?
161, I think.
165, near enough. 11 times 15, 165. Okay. And there's a way to do that. You could, or if I give you 2 5-digit numbers, you could type those into a calculator, hit multiply, and tell me the 10-digit result. But if I give you a 10-digit number, there's nothing on your calculator that would take you backwards. There's nothing on that calculator that will say, well, these are the two numbers you need to multiply together to get this new number. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, but, well, anyway, the reason I called is because I remember reading about this young, I think, Irish girl, Sarah Flannery.
That's right, that's right.
And which I thought was a peculiar story having to do with public key, and apparently she found she discovered something. But then I read later that her father was involved in cryptology. And I was wondering, what was the real story there?
I've met Sarah. I've met her father as well, in fact. I think just a slight misunderstanding. What happened was she wrote a book with her father. Let me go back another stage. She entered a science competition for European scientists, and she got a summer vacation job working with a cryptographic company in Ireland called Baltimore Technologies, I think. So she worked with this company. She was given a project to work on, and she came up with some really clever ideas on cryptography. So she entered this competition, and she won the European Young Scientist of the Year prize. So the work she did, if it was in collaboration at all, it was with the people at Baltimore. But then afterwards, she wrote a really nice book with her father. So that's where the collaboration with her father enters, was in the writing of this book. And it's a lovely book called In Code. And it's partly about cryptography and her work, but it's also about puzzles. Every day at the breakfast table, her father would give her a new puzzle to think about. And she'd think about it during the day, and in the evening, either she'd solve the answer or he'd explain to her what the answer was. So it's about puzzles and how puzzles can be used to inspire children inspire them about mathematics and science and so on.
So the name of it was In Code?
That's right, I-N space C-O-D-E. And I think it's just being published here in America.
Oh, that's interesting. And I also heard that she was going to give away her technique because she wasn't looking for any kind of remuneration. Is that true?
Yeah, she wasn't going to patent it.
Yeah, did she hold to that?
I think. Well, actually, what happened subsequently? Again, the details are a little bit vague, but she then found an error in her own system, a weakness in it, which is really because normally, you know. I come up with a system, and other people suddenly say, look, you've made a mistake. But to find errors in your own work, I think, is really a terrific sign of somebody that really thinks deeply about what they're doing.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Chicago for someone else here. Line 4. Hello.
Well, thank you. I imagine the Genome Project is going to be a wonderful code to learn more about. Once it gets translated into understandable language. And those who want to encrypt things can probably use it as a roadmap for traveling in any direction they want regarding messages. What do you think about that?
Nigel?
Well, one thing I was thinking there is that when we do research, it's almost like trying to decrypt the universe. I mean, officially, I've only been doing cryptography for a few years, but I feel that my whole research life, I've been doing cryptography because what are we trying to do? We're trying to decrypt these strange codes, such as the genome project. And so in a sense, we're all being cryptographers by being researchers, I suppose. Whether that can be used in practice... Well, who knows? I mean, a few years ago they created the DNA computer. So, I mean, people have very inventive ideas. I guess it remains to be seen.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Certainly, there are entities that are concerned about unbreakable code. Governments like ours don't like this idea terribly well, the idea that individuals could exchange information and that no one could know what was in there. And I think that what they would like, government agencies like the National Security Agency, they would like everybody to give them their private keys so that they could monitor communications. And is this something that's still a point of controversy?
Well, this has been debated a lot. This is the idea of key escrow, which is I think in the end that we're going to win. I mean, I equate with the general public, and that you know, so far we seem to be, from what I see, winning the war. I mean, it's the idea that the analogy is that would you let the government have sort of the back door key to your house, you know, so that they can check on you? And they claim that they need this to for surveillance and to fight crime. And well, there's a big argument over it. But just as in the past, the government tried to restrict cryptography. I know Diffie and Hellman and other people ran into great problems. And then the people at RSA and Phil Zimmerman and all these people have had problems with the government trying to constrain what they were allowed to do. But in time, the general public have won out. So it seems like the record is that they're fighting a losing battle on this, I think.
Anything you'd like to add to that, Simon?
Yeah, I think I generally agree with Nigel that the attitude that law enforcers have the right to have access to our messages is a fading one, because it's also impractical. I think for many years America tried to ban the import, or it did ban the export, sorry, of strong encryption. So if I was in London and I bought some software from America, it would not have strong encryption. And that didn't particularly bother me, because I could get a patch off the internet that would make it strong. Or, ultimately, I might just buy it from Ireland. I might buy it from Sarah Flannery's company that's going to be even more secure. So it was kind of pointless of America trying to ban that export. And indeed, last year, I think, they dropped that ban.
Mm-hmm.
And they export, you know, America now exports very strong encryption around the world, apart from one or two countries that it you know, disapproves of. So it's just impractical to do that sort of thing. And also there's a technique called steganography. So far we've been talking about hiding the meaning of a message. Steganography, and that's cryptography. Steganography is all about hiding its very existence. So if a government bans me from using cryptography, or if a government demands to see my keys, then I will just hide my messages. And a government can't then look at something that it can't even find in the first place.
We're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, because we're here at the end of the time. But it's a fascinating subject area, and I just guess I'll mention one more time that our guest here, Simon Singh, will be giving a couple talks on the U of I campus, Cracking Codes and Stealing Secrets for Elementary through High School Students at 1:30 tomorrow at CSL?
Yeah, CSRL. The building is CSRL. The organization is CSL.
Okay. And then the Secret History of Public Key Cryptography, Altgeld Hall, 314, tomorrow afternoon, 4:15. And after that, a book signing at the U of I bookstore, 5:45. This is part of a celebration of 50 years of the Coordinated Science Lab on the U of I campus. Mr. Singh, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And Nigel Boston, thank you very much.
Thank you.